Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, April 30, 2014. After visiting IDPs at UNMISS camp in Jonglei State where civilians were killed, top United Nations human rights officials tell President Kiir and Riek Machar the killings must stop now.
The leadership of the government, the leadership of the opposition must assume high responsibility to ensure that those under their authority do not commit serious violations of human rights or international humanitarian law.
And South Sudan's ruling party wants to put its house in order.
It is so important that the SPLM leadership iron out their differences so that they can turn around and offer leadership for dealing with the crisis that exists now.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Two weeks after the mass killings in Bentiu and Bor, two top UN human rights officials met with President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar in South Sudan. The UN officials also met with survivors of the deadly attack on the UN camp in Bor. They say both Mr. Kiir and Machar must instruct their forces to immediately end the violence. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
Navi Pillay, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and Adama Dieng, the UN Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, met face-to-face with President Salva Kiir, as well as former Vice President Riek Machar, in hopes of ending the 4.5 months of escalating violence. Pillay says the recent killings in Bentiu and the attack on a UN protection camp in Bor, which left more than 50 people dead, shows how close South Sudan is to calamity.
The deadly mix of recrimination, hate speech, and revenge killings that has developed relentlessly over the past 4.5 months seems to be reaching boiling point. And I have been increasingly concerned that neither South Sudan's political leaders nor the international community at large seem to perceive quite how dangerous the situation now is.
Ms. Pillay lashed out at both President Kiir and Machar for embarking on what she described as a personal power struggle that has brought their people to the verge of catastrophe instead of working to develop the country and steer it out of poverty. The UN says the fighting has already displaced more than 1 million people inside South Sudan and that millions will be at risk of famine this year. Pillay chastised the two leaders for what she calls their apparent lack of concern about the risk of famine.
The reaction to a call for 30 days of tranquility to allow people to go home to plant, although it may already be too late for this with the rains starting, was lukewarm. Both leaders said they would if the other did, then made it clear they did not trust the other's words. The prospect of widespread hunger and malnutrition being inflicted on hundreds of thousands of their people because of their personal failure to resolve their differences peacefully did not appear to concern them very much.
Pillay says during meetings with both Kiir and Machar, both leaders expressed readiness to investigate any abuses committed by their forces. But she says lip service is not enough. The two leaders must take concrete action against the perpetrators.
If the people of South Sudan are to believe that there is accountability, these investigations must move swiftly beyond statements of intent to action. In other words, arrests and prosecution must be conducted by an independent body in a transparent process consistent with international standards and principles. This must be carried out quickly and the outcome must be published.
Pillay says without accountability, there is nothing to deter others from killing. She warned both political and military leaders on both sides they could be held accountable for committing war crimes and crimes against humanity, or for failure to prevent their subordinates from committing similar crimes. United Nations Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, Adama Dieng, called on leaders on both sides to ensure their supporters do not commit abuses.
The leadership of the government, the leadership of the opposition, must assume high responsibility to ensure that those under their authority do not commit serious violations of human rights or international humanitarian law. They should send strong messages to call for the unity and respect of all South Sudanese and take immediate measures to end the violence.
Dieng says unless those responsible for committing crimes are held to account, the cycle of deadly revenge attacks would continue.
I beseech everyone, the South Sudanese, their leaders, the regional and the international community, to take immediate measures to end the violence and uphold our collective responsibility to protect the populations of South Sudan from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity.
Dieng says ethnicity should never be used as a reason to incite violence or demonize any community, adding the world is watching. Both Pillay and Dieng will report their findings to the Secretary General. The two officials left South Sudan today. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Another high-profile official is traveling to South Sudan. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is heading to Africa for talks on violence in South Sudan and the Central African Republic. VOA's State Department correspondent Scott Stans is traveling with the secretary and has this story.
A senior State Department official traveling with Secretary Kerry says the top U.S. diplomat will be delivering tough messages to both sides in South Sudan that they'll be held accountable if they don't take the necessary actions to end the hostilities. The United States has in place a mechanism for a travel ban and assets freeze on individuals responsible for violence that followed allegations of a December coup attempt. Secretary Kerry says President Barack Obama is now looking very closely at imposing those sanctions.
That sanctions are one of the things that have to take impact. We're evaluating that now.
In Addis Ababa, Kerry will meet with his counterparts from Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya in hopes of getting them to join economic sanctions and a travel ban. A senior administration official says South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and his former vice president, now rival Riek Machar, both appear to believe they can win militarily, and neither have the country's best good in their hearts. Secretary Kerry will be briefed on the violence by former Nigerian leader Olusegun Obasanjo, who heads an African Union Commission of Inquiry. At the AU, Kerry will meet with officials on peacekeeping efforts in the Central African Republic, where he says it's regrettable that China joined Russia in blocking United Nations sanctions.
Without the UN sanction, it becomes much more difficult to be able to take the steps that we think are necessary.
On this trip, Kerry will also meet with Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed to discuss the fight against the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab militia. He'll travel to Kinshasa to meet with President Joseph Kabila about security in eastern Congo, where a senior State Department official says there's some success after many, many years of conflict. Those talks will include amnesty for some M23 rebels, as well as Congolese judicial accountability for some of their leaders. Secretary Kerry also will visit Angola for talks with President José Eduardo dos Santos, who a senior State Department official says has played an extraordinarily positive role in helping resolve crises in both the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Central African Republic. Kerry will meet with civil society and business leaders in Ethiopia and Angola. There's a microfinance event in Congo, as well as a meeting with UN Special Representative Martin Kobler. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Western Bahr al-Ghazal state officials say six army officers who fled Wau over the weekend have surrendered and returned. Officials promise they will not be punished for leaving and are encouraging nearly 60 other officers who fled to come back to the army. Michael Atit has this story for VOA from Wau.
Major Simon Mongok was patrolling Wau on Saturday evening when he heard about the attack on trainees in Mapel. State officials say military families attacked Santa trainees based in their ethnicity. At least five were killed. Mongok, who is from the same ethnic group as the trainees, says he was scared he would be next.
There was a group that wanted to join the rebellion, but I was not part of that group. I was just afraid. So I ran to a place. From there, I communicated with the governor and he told me I could come back. I did not intend to go to the bush. But definitely, if someone is afraid, they will run away.
Mongok says he does not know how many of the 64 officers who fled well over the weekend defected to the opposition or how many are in hiding. He called on the officers who were staying out of sight to return to their positions in Wau. Governor Rizik Zakaria Hassan says the state officials are in talks with the other officers to convince them to return, though he declined to say how many. He says he has informed all of the officers he spoke to that if they return, they can resume their position in Sudan People's Liberation Army.
We will also allow them to reside in the UN compound until they recover their confidence. After that, they can decide what they want to do. For our colleagues who left Wau and those who left Mapel, we appeal to them to come back. They can report themselves to the nearest government office.
United Nations officials say more than 700 people are still living at the UN compound in Wau, where they fled over the weekend following the Mapel attacks. Civilians staying at the camp say they are still too afraid to go home. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says it is racing to provide essential supplies for hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese displaced by war before rains make roads impassable. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Nearly 1 million South Sudanese have become internally displaced since fighting between government and opposition forces broke out 4 months ago. They are spread across about 175 makeshift and organized sites, with the largest number in Upper Nile State. UNHCR spokeswoman Fatoumata Lejeune Kaba describes conditions in most of these sites as appalling. She says they lack water and sanitation. She blames the terrible conditions on underfunding and lack of security.
It's not everywhere that we can access all the time. The lines of fighting move constantly. The displaced themselves move constantly. So even if they receive assistance in one place and they are forced again to flee because of new fighting, they find themselves with nothing. It's overcrowded for most of them, including, of course, at the UN bases. The sites are not proper at all.
Lejeune Kaba says the UNHCR is airlifting more relief supplies Tuesday from Dubai to the capital, Juba, for 100,000 displaced people. She says the blankets, sleeping mats, water buckets, and other relief items will be distributed mainly in Unity, Upper Nile, and Jonglei states. The UNHCR also is assisting thousands of South Sudanese civilians who have fled to Sudan in search of asylum. Lejeune Kaba tells VOA the agency's priority is to relocate 23,000 South Sudanese in White Nile State away from where they presently are staying.
We've had visits there to the relocation areas, and it seems like people will be willing to go. It's important because very soon we won't be able to access the Kilo 10 site. So most likely people will move and relocate.
Lejeune Kaba says it already is raining in White Nile State, but the heaviest rains usually begin in May. Meanwhile, the UNHCR and its partners also are providing aid to tens of thousands of South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia. She says aid agencies are expanding accommodation for nearly 100,000 refugees in the Gambela region in the west of the country. She says land is being cleared for a fifth camp near Kule for up to 30,000 people. She says the camp is expected to open early next month. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The acting Secretary General of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement says both the government and former political detainees have agreed to participate in a meeting of the party's senior members in Addis Ababa. She says members of the opposition have also been invited to the dialogue, but have yet to respond to the invitation. Philip Aleu has details for VOA from Juba.
Acting Secretary General Anne Eto says the meeting of the Protocol Veru will focus on governance, but they will also look at simmering issues that led to the split within the ruling party last December. She says President Salva Kiir sent a delegation to meet with the seven political detainees released in January, and they have agreed to attend. She says the four politicians released last week, including former Secretary General Pagana Amom, might also be at the talks.
The idea is to offer a forum for all members of SPLM to come and talk their differences and agree on how best to unify their ranks and how best to come up with some solutions to deal with the current national crisis, because it is so important that the SPLM leadership iron out their differences so that they can turn around and offer leadership for dealing with the crisis that exists now.
Eto says the meeting will be held in Addis Ababa and mediated by officials from South Africa and its various ruling parties. She says it is up to those officials to set a date for the dialogue. She says officials have not heard back from former Vice President Riek Machar on whether to attend the meeting. She says even though President Kiir kicked him out of the party in February, he was invited to the meeting because his attendance will be one step closer toward bringing the country back together. She says the SPLM leadership regrets the political fraction within the party has resulted in more than 10,000 people losing their lives, according to some observers.
Both sides to the conflict are not innocent. Innocent civilian has died in the hands of both sides. The only difference with the government is that the president has formed committees in the army to take care of those who are accused of causing atrocities. To me, that is a plus because it demonstrates that he understands war, but he also understands when you do war, you don't do it with the civilians.
Neither the executive nor the army has announced when they will complete the investigations or when the result will be released. For BOA News, I'm Philip Aleu in Juba.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Being bitten by a dog is painful and can be very dangerous. It can cause infection and even rabies. Children are particularly vulnerable to dog attacks because they are short and their faces are usually close to the animals. To protect yourself and your family, avoid strange dogs and teach children to stay away from them. If a strange dog approaches you, remain calm and avoid direct eye contact, which the dog can understand as aggression. Never run from a dog. They like to chase moving objects, and most dogs can run faster than people can. If you are attacked, try to stand still with your feet together. Protect your neck and face with your arms and hands. Then call for help. And if you or someone you know has been bitten and the skin has been broken, seek medical treatment immediately.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, an update on U.S. sanctions against Sudan. That story is coming up next.
You don't want to miss VOA's South Sudan in Focus. You can hear us on one of our FM affiliate stations around the country or on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan. In Juba, listen to South Sudan in Focus at 8 p.m. on 93.5. You can also find us on shortwave at 11995, 13870, and 15180 kilohertz. Or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? people speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the importance of elections?
Election is good because the one who will be elected is by the people, and that one will be the man of the people, and that government will be the government of the people. That's why election is good.
It's very important because we decide who makes decisions, and we decide how our countries run and how we live, because the people in power like decide everything. It affects everything.
Elections are important because you get to hear from the voice of the people. Dictatorships typically are not positive things. They tend to be governments that come and oppress the people, that break the spirit of a nation. And so I think elections allow people to come together and choose the leader that they will back and support, the leader that they believe in.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir says continued U.S. sanctions on his country are unfair. Mr. Bashir was speaking at the third Tanana Forum on Security held in Ethiopia this week. Information Minister Ahmed Bilal tells VOA reporter James Batty, Sudan is not a terrorism sponsor and can help end the conflict in South Sudan if given a chance.
We have been promised by the Americans, first of all, if you could make peace with the South and we make agreement, they will lift it immediately after that. And we have done that. Till the referendum, we were the first country to recognize the South as an independent country. And in spite of lifting the extended, made another extension, they said if you make peace in Darfur, we are searching everywhere, we are going everywhere, we are calling for that, and we did all our efforts and they did nothing. And there is no assistance for peace. Till now we are calling for actually dialogue with all the people, and we are going, we are ready to make everything possible for a democratic state in Sudan and for sort of making peace in all of Sudan. But in fact, there is no actually any sort of, not a reward, but any promise have been done, have been said to us. It is not fulfilled.
As you know, Mr. Minister, the United States imposed the sanctions on your country because of your country's alleged connection to terror networks and human rights abuses. Are you saying that your country has made improvement in that area?
In fact, actually for two things. They are saying that we are hoping terrorism, and this is not true. Now we made agreements with all our neighbors. We have good relations with all our neighbors. We are calling for joint troops. A success story we have been done with Chad, with Central Africa, with Ethiopia. Now we are going to do this with South of Sudan, with Egypt. And this is to prove that we are not actually hosting any sort of terrorism. For the human rights, and the last actually decrees have been done by the president. Now we have a very wide margin of freedom. The press is totally free. The parties are totally free to move, to organize, to make demonstrations, everything. Above that, we are calling for national dialogue.
You mentioned South Sudan. Of course, you know the United States is considering sanctions against the rebels or the government in South Sudan because of the massacre in Bentiu.
Actually, the sanctions will not help. This is will increase the sufferings of the people. What is going actually in the South Sudan is a crazy thing, and it is going to be deepened every now and then. And we think the solution is very easy. And I assure you, if as Sudan being given any hand for this, we can make peace in the South of Sudan in just 2 weeks.
That's Ahmed Bilal, Sudanese Information Minister, speaking to reporter James Batty earlier this week. The story of the Somali-American teenager who survived 5 hours in the wheel of a jet flying from California to Hawaii has drawn intense coverage in the international media. But for some Somali communities in the United States and elsewhere, the story is a reminder of the challenges facing families who fled war in Somalia only to struggle with huge cultural adjustment to their new home. VOA's Pam Dawkins tells us more in this report prepared by Mohamed Olad.
Medical experts say Yahya Abdi was very lucky to survive the thin air and sub-zero temperatures he encountered while tucked inside the wheel well of a jet flying at more than 11,000 meters. One of the questions that immediately rose after this harrowing incident was what could force a teenager like Yahya to risk his life. In separate interviews with VOA, both Yahya's father and mother said extreme homesickness could have been the reason. According to law enforcement officials, the teen had argued with his father's family in California and was trying to reach Somalia to see his mother. Abdinur Sheikh Mohammed is an education consultant with Ohio State University. Speaking in Somali, he says, the family structure was broken in general by the process of looking for a second home. Refugees in general go through these difficulties in bringing all these families together. In the U.S., we have a family reunification process where family members who scattered across the world can be brought together in the U.S., even though it takes a long process. Hashi Shafi, executive director of the Minneapolis-based organization Somali Action Alliance, says Yahya is not alone in missing family members left behind in Somalia.
The young kid now was one of the examples, but really it's not only him. But I know many young kids in Minnesota who have been struggling lately. And some of them, when you engage them in conversation, they tell you up front, I'm really missing my mom, who I have not seen her for 15 years or 10 years.
More than two decades of lawlessness and civil war has forced hundreds of thousands of Somalis to leave the country. Most of them say either they would have been caught in the crossfire or starved to death if they had stayed at home. The ones coming to the U.S. have largely settled in the city of Minneapolis. While Americans have mostly welcomed the immigrants, the Somalis have faced difficulties with language and a radically different culture. Abdi Salan Sharif Adam, an English as a second language teacher in Minneapolis, says family disintegration is to blame for some other major problems existing within the Somali American community.
We do notice that many families do not have the entire family together. So there's a gap in that area that we really feel. The issue of identity of who am I? Am I Somali? Am I Muslim? Am I American? That question is unclear to many of the students, and they get different messages, conflicting messages from their elders.
16-year-old Yahya Abdi felt that pain and took that risk when he stowed away on the flight last Sunday. His survival will bring him a certain notoriety, but it does not reunite his family. I'm Pam Dawkins for Mohammed Olad Hassan for VOA News, Washington.
And that story brings us to the end of this show today on Wednesday. We leave you with the song Kafara Le Siasa by Emmanuel Kembe.
Parnal ki kore radio mdurman geni ataku. Equatoria kore radio mdurman geni ataku. Ana indu question wahid kuliom bihibu asalu. Ana indu question wahid kuliom bihibu asalu. Anina almazlumin gishakil ashan shunu deye. Anina almazlumin ginadil ashan shunu deya. Lakin malu pinastanin gishakil ashan kursi ugurush. Malu pinastanin ginadil besashan kursi ugurush. Tishofu malela figaba ubukura fi medina. Bijere legaba ubirijale jalaba. Alela figaba ubukura fi medina.
We have been listening to Emmanuel Kembe with that song, Kafara Le Siasa. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope you will join us back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Come, Alf Miskin, be mutu yade, for example.